Chapter 23. Tempus est umbra in mente. Hazy history. Cla. A note. Seedings. 1. When I was a freshman at Hillview, I took Latin 1. I did it because learning a dead language seemed like a cool idea, and because my dad told me that my mom took it at the same school from the same teacher, Miss Young. He said mom thought she was cool. By the time my turn came around, Miss Young, who taught French as well as Latin, was no longer young, but she was still cool. There were only 8 of us in the class, and there was no Latin 2 when I was a sophomore because Miss Young retired, and that part of the HHS language program was closed down. On our first day in class, Miss Young asked if we knew any Latin phrases. Carla Johansson raised her hand and said carpe diem, which meant seize the day. No one else was offering, so I raised my hand and gave one I'd heard from my Uncle Bob, usually when he had to get going somewhere. Tempus fugit, meaning time flies. Miss Young nodded, and when nobody else offered, she gave us some more, like ad hoc, de facto, and bona fide. When class ended, she called me back, said she remembered my mother well and was sorry I'd lost her so young. I thanked her. No tears, not after 6 years, but I got a lump in my throat.
Tempus fugit is a good one, she said. But time doesn't always fly, as everyone who's ever had to wait around for something knows. I think tempus est umbra in mente is a better one. Roughly translated, it means time is a shadow in the mind.
I thought of that often in deep Malene. Because we were entombed, the only way to tell night from day was that in daylight somewhere, not in our durance vial, the night soldiers came less frequently. Their blue auras were reduced when they did, and their human faces became more apparent. For the most part, they were unhappy faces, tired, haggard. I wondered if these creatures had, when still human, made some sort of devil's bargain, which they regretted now that it was too late to cry it off. Maybe not Aaron and a few of the others, certainly not the Lord High. But the rest? Maybe. Or maybe I was just seeing what I wanted to see. I thought I kept a rough hold on time during my first week in the dungeon, but after that I lost track. I believe we were taken up to the stadium for playtime every 5 or 6 days, but for the most part, they were just practices and not bloody. The one exception was when Yano, I'm sorry to keep throwing these names at you, but you have to remember there were 30 prisoners besides me, swung his fighting stick too hard at Eris. She ducked, he missed by a mile, and dislocated his shoulder. This did not surprise me. Yano, like the majority of my fellows, had never been what you'd call a Dwayne Johnson type to begin with, and being locked in a cell for the majority of the time hadn't exactly built him up. I exercised in my cell. Few of the others did. Another prisoner, Freed, fixed Yano's shoulder when we were returned to the team room. He told Yan to hold still, grabbed him by the elbow, and yanked. I heard the clunk as Yano's shoulder went back into place.
That was good, I said as we were escorted back to Malene.
Freed shrugged.
I used to be a doctor in the Citadel many years ago.
Only years wasn't the word he used. I know I've said that before, you know I've said it before, but I need to explain, try, at least, why nothing ever quite fit in my mind. I always heard years, but when I asked questions about Empus and that word was used, it seemed to mean different things to different people. I got a picture of Empusarian history as the weeks, used advisedly, passed, but never a coherent timeline. In Dad's AA meetings, beginners were advised to take the cotton out of their ears and stick it in their mouths. Learn to listen so you can listen to learn, they say.
I sometimes asked questions, but mostly I kept my ears open and my mouth shut. They talked because there was little else to do. They argued about when thus and such had happened, or if it had happened at all. They told stories their parents and grandparents had told them. A picture began to form, hazy, but better than no picture at all. Once upon a time, long ago, the monarchy had been a real monarchy with a real army, for all I know, even a navy. Sort of like England was, I suppose, in the days of James, Charles, and Henry with all the wives. These empress kings of yore, I can't say if there was ever a queen in charge, that's one of many things I don't know, were supposedly chosen by the high gods. Their rule was unquestioned. They were almost considered to be gods themselves, and for all I knew, they were. Is it so hard to believe that kings and maybe members of their family could levitate, strike enemies dead with a cross look, or heal sickness by touching in a land where there were mermaids and giants? At some point, the Gallians became the ruling family. According to my fellow prisoners, that was, you guessed it, many years ago. But as time passed, I'm guessing maybe 5 or 6 generations, the Gallians began to loosen the royal grip. In the time leading up to the Grey, Empis was a monarchy in name only. The royal family's still a big deal, but no longer the be-all and end-all. Take the Citadel. Doc Freed told me it was run by a council of 7, and the councillors were elected. He spoke of the Citadel as if it were this big, important city, but the picture I got was of a small and wealthy town that prospered on trade between Seafront and Lillimar. Maybe other towns or principalities like Dísk and Ullum, at least before Ullum went all gaga religious, were about the same, each with its own specialty, the inhabitants of each just going about their business. The prisoners, most of whom became my friends, complicated by their belief that I was or might be some magical prince, knew only a little of Lillimar and the palace, not because it was a big secret, but because they had their own lives and towns to take care of. They paid tribute to King Jan, Double actually thought he was King Jam, like something you'd spread on bread, because the amounts demanded were reasonable, and because the army, much reduced by then and renamed the King's Guard, kept up the roads and bridges. Tribute also paid for some fellows Tom called the Riding Sheriffs and Amit called the Possemen. These were the words I heard. The people of Empis also paid tribute because Jan was, ta-da, the king, and because folks tend to do what tradition demands. They probably bitched a little, the way people always do about paying taxes, then forgot all about it until the Empisarian equivalent of April 15th came around again. What about the magic, you ask? The sundial, the night soldiers, the buildings that sometimes seem to change their shapes. They took it for granted. If you find that strange, imagine a time traveler from 1910 being transported to 2010 and finding a world where people flew through the sky in giant metal birds and rode in cars capable of going 90 miles an hour. A world where everyone went bopping around with powerful computers in their pockets. Or imagine a guy who's only seen a few silent black and white films plunked down in the front row of an IMAX theater and watching Avatar in 3D. You get used to the amazing, that's all. Mermaids and IMAX, giants and cell phones. If it's in your world, you go with it. It's wonderful, right? Only look at it another way and it's sort of awful. Think Gogmagog is scary? Our world is sitting on a potentially world-ending supply of nuclear weapons. And if that's not black magic, I don't know what is. 2. In Empis, kings came and went. For all I knew, the preserved bodies of the Gallians were kept in one of those huge gray buildings Radar and I had passed as we followed Mr. Bowditch's initials to the sundial. King Jan was anointed with the usual rituals. Bolt claimed a sacred cup made of gold was involved. Jacka insisted that Jan's wife was Queen Clara, or maybe Kara, but most of the others insisted she had been Cora, and that she and Jan were third cousins or something. None of my fellows seemed to know how many children they'd had. Some said 4, some said 8, and Amit swore there were 10.
"Those two must have fucked like royal rabbits," he said.
According to what I knew from a certain princess's horse, they were all wrong. There had been 7, 5 girls and 2 boys. And this is where the story got interesting to me. You could even say relevant, although it remained maddeningly hazy. King Jan fell ill. His son Robert, who'd always been the favored one, as well as the older of the 2 boys, waited in the wings, ready to drink from the sacred cup. I imagined engraved butterflies around the rim. Eldon, the younger brother, was pretty well forgotten, except by Leah, that was, who idolized him.
"By all accounts, he was an ugly, limping fuck,"
Dommy said one night.
"Not one clubfoot, but both of them."
"Warty, too, I heard,"
Akka said.
"Hump on his back,"
Fremy said.
"Heard it was a lump on his neck,"
Stook said. It was interesting to me, even illuminating, that they talked about Eldon, the ugly, limping, nearly forgotten prince, and the flight killer as 2 different people. Or like a caterpillar that morphs into a butterfly. At least part of the king's guard had also morphed, I believed, into the night soldiers. Eldon was jealous of his brother, and jealousy grew into hatred. All of them seemed to agree on this point, and why not? It was a classic story of sibling rivalry that would have been at home in any fairy tale. I knew good stories are not always true stories, or not completely true, but this one was plausible enough, human nature being what it is. Eldon decided to take the kingship, either by force or by guile, and be revenged on his family. If Empus as a whole also suffered, so be it. Did the Grey come before or after Eldon became the flight killer? Some of my fellows said before, but I think it was after. I think he brought it somehow. One thing I'm sure of is how he got his new name.
"The butterflies were everywhere in Empus,"
Dockfried said.
"They darkened the skies."
This was after the practice when he yanked Yano's shoulder back in place. We were returning to our dungeon keep, walking side by side. Doc was speaking low, almost whispering. It was easier to talk going down the stairs, and the pace was slow because we were tired out. What he said made me think of how passenger pigeons had once darkened the skies of the Midwest. Until they were hunted out of existence, that was. Only who would hunt monarch butterflies? "Were they good to eat?" I asked. That was, after all, why the passenger pigeons went bye-bye. They were cheap food on the wing. He snorted.
"Monarchs are poisonous, Charlie. Eat one, you might only get an upset stomach. Eat a handful, and you could die. They were everywhere, as I say, but they were especially thick in Lillimar and the suburbs that surround it."
Did he say suburbs or smallies? It came to the same thing.
"People grew milkweed in their gardens for the larvae to eat, and flowers for the butterflies to drink nectar from when they emerged. They were considered the luck of the kingdom."
I thought of all the defaced statues I'd seen, spread wings hammered to rubble.
"The story goes that once Eldon's family was killed, and only he was left, he walked through the streets in a red robe with a snowy ermine collar, the golden crown of the galleons on his head. The skies were dark with monarchs, as was typical, but each time Eldon raised his hands, thousands fell dead from the skies. When the people fled the city, a few stayed, paid homage, swore allegiance. They ran through drifts of dead butterflies. It's said that inside the city wall, those drifts were 10 feet deep. Millions of dead monarchs, with their bright colors fading to gray."
"That's awful," I said. We were almost back by then. Do you believe it?
I know they also died in the Citadel. I saw them dropping out of the skies myself. Others will tell you the same.
He brushed at his eyes, then looked up at me.
I'd give a deal to see a butterfly while we're out on that playing field. Just one. But I suppose they're all gone.
No, I said. I've seen them. A lot of them. He took my arm, his grip surprisingly strong for a little man. Although if the fair one came, I didn't think the dock would last much longer than Hamie.
Is that the truth? Do you swear it?
Yes.
On your mother's name now.
One of our guards looked back, frowning, and made a threatening gesture with his limber stick before facing forward again.
On my mother's name,
I said, keeping it low. The monarchs weren't gone, and neither were the galleons. Not all, at least. They had been cursed by whatever power now lived in Eldon, the same power that had reduced the closer suburbs to rubble, I assumed, but they were alive. I didn't tell Freed that, though. It might have been dangerous for both of us. I thought of Woody's story about Hannah chasing the remains of his family to the city gates, and how she had swatted off the head of Woody's nephew, Aloysius.
When did Hannah come? Why did she come, if the giants live in the north?
He shook his head.
I don't know.
I thought that perhaps Hannah had been on a visit to the home folks in Cratchy when Mr. Bowditch made his last gold-getting expedition, but there was no way to tell. He was dead, and as I say, Empisarian history was hazy. That night I lay awake a long time. I wasn't thinking about Empis, or the butterflies, or the flight killer. I was thinking about my father. Missing him, and worrying about him. For all I knew, he might think I was as dead as my mother. 3. Time slipped away, unmarked and uncounted. I gathered my little crumbs of information, although for what purpose, I wasn't sure. Then, one day, we came back from a practice slightly more arduous than the others had been lately, to find a bearded man, a lot bigger than either me, Dommy, or Iota, in Iota's cell. He was dressed in muddy short pants and an equally muddy striped shirt, the sleeves cut off to show slabs of muscle. He was squatting on his hunkers in the corner, knees up around his ears, as far from the blue presence also occupying the cell as he could get, the blue presence being the Lord High. Kellen held up one hand. The gesture was almost lackadaisical, but the pair of night soldiers leading us stopped at once and stood at attention. We all stopped. Jaya was beside me that day, and her hand crept into mine. It was very cold. Kellen stepped out of Eye's cell and looked us over.
My dear friends, I would like you to meet your new compatriot. His name is Kla. He was found on the shore of Lake Remla after his little boat sprang a leak. He nearly drowned, didn't you, Kla?
Kla said nothing, only looked at Kellen.
Answer me!
Yes, I almost drowned.
Try again. Address me as Lord High.
Yes, Lord High. I almost drowned.
Kellen turned back to us.
But he was rescued, my dear friends, and, as I'm sure you can see, there is not a bloom of grey anywhere on him. Just dirt.
Kellen tittered. It was an awful sound. Jaya's hand tightened on mine.
Introductions aren't common in Deep Meline, as you no doubt know, but I felt my new dear friend, Claw, warranted one, because he is our 32nd guest. Isn't that wonderful?
No one said anything. Kellen pointed at one of the night soldiers at the head of our unlucky procession, then at Bernd, who was in front beside Amit. The night soldier hit Bernd in the neck with his stick. Bernd screamed, went to his knees, and clapped his hand over an ooze of blood. Kellen bent toward him.
What is your name? I won't apologize for having forgotten. There are so many of you.
Bernd,
he choked.
Bernd of the Citadel.
No such place as the Citadel,
Kellen said.
Not now.
And not ever again. Just Bernd will do. So tell me, Bernd of nowhere at all. Is it wonderful that King Elden, the Flight Killer, now has 32? Answer up, loud and proud.
Yes,
Bernd said. Blood dripped between his clutching fingers.
Yes, what?
And then, as if teaching a small child to read.
One, loud and proud now.
Wonderful,
Bernd said, looking down at the wet stones of the corridor.
Woman,
Kellen said.
You, Erin. Is it Erin?
Yes, Lord High,
Eris said. No way was she going to correct him.
Is it wonderful that Clara has joined us?
Yes, Lord High.
How wonderful.
Very wonderful, Lord High.
Is it your cunt that stinks or your asshole, Erin?
Eris's face was a blank, but her eyes were on fire. She lowered them, which was wise.
Probably both, Lord High.
Yes, I think both. You now, Iota. Step to me.
I stepped forward, almost to the protective blaze of blue surrounding Kellen.
Are you happy to have a cellmate?
Yes, Lord High.
Is it one?
Kellen flapped one white hand, and I realized he was happy. No, not just happy. Over the moon. Or, considering where we were, moons. And why not? He'd been set a gathering task, and it was now complete. I also realized how much I hated him. I also hated the Flight Killer, sight unseen.
Wonderful.
Kellen slowly reached toward Iota, who tried to stand his ground but flinched back when the hand was less than an inch from his face. I heard the air crackle and saw Ai's hair stir in response to whatever force was keeping Kellen alive.
Wonderful what, Iota?
Wonderful, Lord High.
Kellen had had his fun. He strode through us impatiently. We tried to get away, but some weren't fast enough and got walloped by his aura. They went to their knees, some silent, some whimpering in pain. I pushed Jaya out of his way, but my arm entered the blue envelope around him, and scalding pain ran up to my shoulder, locking all of the muscles. It was 2 long minutes before they loosened.
They should let the gray slaves go free and run their old generator on that power, I thought.
At the door, Kellen spun to face us, finishing with a stamp of his foot, like a Prussian drill instructor.
Listen to me, dear friends. Barring a few exiles who don't matter, and a few fugitive whole people who may have scarpered in the early days of Flight Killer's reign, you are the last of the royal blood. The watered-down spawn of rakes, rascals, and rapists. You will serve at Flight Killer's pleasure, and you will serve soon. Playtime is over. The next time you step on the field of Elden, formerly the field of the Monarchs, it will be for the first round of the Fair One.
What about him, Lord High? I asked, pointing at Claw with the arm that still worked. Doesn't he get a chance to practice?
Kellen gazed at me with a thin smile. Behind his eyes, I could see the empty sockets of his skull.
You will be his practice, kiddie. He survived Lake Remla, and he'll survive you. Look at the size of him. Nah, when it's the second round, you'll not be taking part, my insolent friend. And I, for one, will be glad to be rid of you.
With those comforting words, he left. 4. It was steak for dinner that night. It almost always was after playtime. Percy rolled his cart up the corridor, tossing the half-cooked meat into our cells. 16 cells, each now occupied by 2 prisoners. Percy once more raised his malformed hand to his brow as he tossed me mine. It was a quick and furtive gesture, but there was no mistaking it. Claw caught his chunk on the fly and sat in the corner, holding the half-raw meat in his hands and snaffling it down in big, tearing bites. What big teeth you have, Claw, I thought. Hamey ate a few token bites of his, then tried to give it to me. I wouldn't take it.
You can manage more than that.
For what reason?
He asked.
Why eat, suffer the cramps, then die anyway?
I fell back on my father's acquired wisdom. One day at a time. As if there were days in Moline. But he ate a few more bites to please me. I was the promised prince, after all, the fabled PP. Although the only magic in me had to do with mysterious changes in hair and eye color, and that was magic I had no control over and no use for. I asked Claw about his near drowning. Claw did not reply. Fremy and Stooks wanted to know where he'd come from and where he had been going. Was there a safe haven somewhere? Claw did not reply. Gully wanted to know how long he'd been on the dodge. Claw did not reply. He ate his meat and wiped greasy fingers on his striped shirt.
Don't talk much without the Lord High in front of you, do you?
Double asked. He was standing at the bars of the cell he shared with Burned, a few down from mine. He was holding his last bit of steak, which I knew he would save for later if he woke up in the night. The routines of prison are sad but simple. Claw replied from his corner without getting up or looking up.
Why would I talk to those who will soon be dead? I understand there's to be a contest. Very well. I'll win it. If there's a prize, I'll take it and be on my way.
We greeted this in thunderstruck silence. Finally, Fremy said,
He don't understand.
Got bad information,
Stooks said.
Or maybe there was still water in his ears and he didn't hear so good.
Iota dipped from their bucket, drank, then jumped up on the bars of the cell that had been a single until today, stretching his muscles and shaking the bars, as was his wont. Then let go and turned to face the oversized galoot hunkered in the corner.
Let me explain something to you, Claw, he said. Clarify, as it said. The Fair One is a tournament. Such tourneys were often held on the field of the Monarchs during the days of the Galleons, and people came in their thousands to watch. From everywhere they came, even giant fellows from Cratchy, 'tis said. The contestants were usually members of the King's Guard, although ordinary folk could participate if they wanted to test the hardness of their skulls. There was blood, and combatants were often carried unconscious from the field. But this is to be the old version, from long before the Galleons, when Lilimar was only a village not much bigger than Deesk.
I knew some of this, but even after long days and weeks, not all. I listened intently. So did the rest, because we in Durance Vile rarely discussed the Fair One. It was a taboo subject, as I imagine the electric chair was in the old days, and lethal injection is now.
16 of us will fight the other 16. To the death. No quarter, no crying off. Anyone who refuses to fight will find himself or herself on the rack, or in the maiden, or pulled like taffy candy on the strapado. Do you understand?
Kla sat in his corner, seeming to consider. At last he said,
I can fight.
I nodded.
Yes, you look like you can when you're not facing the Lord High or spitting up lake water. The 16 fight again, leaving 8. The 8 fight again, leaving 4. 4 becomes 2.
Kla nodded.
I'll be one of those. And when the other man lies dead at my feet, I'll claim my prize.
Yes, you will,
Hamie said. He had come to stand beside me.
In the old days, the prize was a bag of gold and, 'tis said, a life's freedom from the king's levy. But that was the old days. Your prize will be to fight Red Molly. She's a giant, and too big for the special box where Flight Killer's lickspittle sit. But I've seen her, many times, standing below it. You're big. Almost 7 feet, I judge. But the red bitch is bigger.
She not catch me, Dash said. She slow, I fast. They ain't called me Dash for no reason.
No one said the obvious. Fast or not, scrawny Dash would be long gone before anyone had to face Red Molly. Kla sat, thinking this over. At last he got up, big knees cracking like knots in a fire, and approached the drinking bucket. He said,
I'll beat her too. Hit her until her brains come out of her mouth.
Let's say you do, I said. He turned to me.
You still won't be done. Kill the daughter, you probably won't, but say you do, and you won't stand a chance against the mother. I've seen her. She's fucking Godzilla.
That wasn't, of course, the word that came out of my mouth, but whatever I said, there were murmurs of agreement from the other cells.
You've all been beaten down until you're scared of your own shadows,
Kla said, perhaps forgetting that when Kellen had told Kla to address him as Lord High, he had done so at once. Of course, Kellen and the rest of the night soldiers were different. They had those auras. I thought of how my muscles had locked up when Kellen touched me. Kla picked up the bucket of drinking water. Iota seized his slab of an arm.
Nah, use the cup, dummy. Percy won't bring the water cart again until...
I never saw a man as big as Kla move so fast. Not even in ESPN classic highlights of Shaquille O'Neal when he played college hoops for LSU. And even at 7 feet and 320 pounds, Shaq had had sublime moves. The bucket was at Claw's mouth and tilting. A second later, or so it seemed, it was clattering across the stone floor, the water spilling. Kla turned to look at it. I was on the cell floor, propped on one hand. The other was at his throat. His eyes bulged. He was gagging. Kla bent for the bucket and picked it up.
If you killed him, you'll pay a high price,
Yano said, then added with unmistakable relief.
There won't be no fair one.
There will be,
Hamie said dolefully.
Flight Killer won't wait. Red Molly'll take I's place.
But I wasn't killed. He eventually got to his feet, staggered to his pallet, and lay down on it. For the next 2 days, he couldn't speak above a whisper. Until Kla came, he was the biggest of us, the strongest, the one you would have expected to still be standing when the blood sport known as the Fair One came to an end.
Yet I had never even seen the throat punch that took him down. Who was supposed to stand against a man who could do that in the first round of the competition? According to Kellen, that honor would go to me. 5. I often dreamed of Radar, but on the night after Claw took Iota down, I dreamed of Princess Leia. She wore a red dress with an empire waist and a tightly fitted bodice. Peeping from beneath the hem were matching red shoes, their buckles encrusted with diamonds. Her hair was tied back with a complicated rope of pearls. She wore a golden locket in the shape of a butterfly on the swell of her bosom. I was sitting beside her, not dressed in the rags of the clothes I'd been wearing when I came to Empus with my sick and dying dog, but in a dark suit and a white shirt. The suit was velvet. The shirt was silk. On my feet were suede boots with folded tops, the sort of boots a Dumas musketeer might wear in a Howard Pyle illustration. From Dora's collection, no doubt. Falada was grazing contentedly nearby, while Leah's gray-skinned handmaid groomed her with a brush. Leah and I were holding hands and looking at our reflections in a still pool of water. My hair was long and golden. My few spots of acne were gone. I was handsome and Leah was beautiful. Especially so, because her mouth had returned. Her lips were curved in a small smile. There were dimples at the corners of her mouth, but no sign of a sore. Soon, if the dream held, I would kiss those red lips. Even in this dream, I recognized it for what it was, the final sequence of an animated Disney film. At any moment, a petal would fall into the pool, rippling the water and making our reflections waver as the lips of the reunited prince and princess met and the music soared. No darkness would be allowed to mar the perfect storybook ending. Only one thing was out of place. In the lap of her red dress, Princess Leia was holding a purple hairdryer. I knew it well, even though I'd only been 7 when my mother died. All of her useful things, including that, had gone to the Goodwill store, because my father said every time he looked at what he called her woman stuff, his heart broke again. I had no problem with him giving most of it away, only asked if I could keep her pine sachet and her hand mirror. Dad had no problem with that, either. They were still on my dresser at home. Mom had called her hairdryer the purple ray gun of death. I opened my mouth to ask Leah why she had my mom's hairdryer, but before I could, her maid spoke.
Help her.
I don't know how, I said. Leah smiled with her new and perfect mouth. She stroked my cheek.
You're faster than you think, Prince Charlie.
I started to tell her I wasn't fast at all, which was why I'd played on the line in football and first base in baseball. It was true I'd shown some speed in the Turkey Bowl game against Stanford, but that had been a short and adrenaline-fueled exception. Before I could say anything, though, something hit me in the face and I jerked awake. It was another piece of steak, a small one, hardly more than a scrap. Percy shuffled down the corridor, tossing a few more small pieces into other cells, saying,
Leftovers! Leftovers!
Which I assumed was the best he could do with leftovers. Hamie was snoring away, exhausted by playtime and his usual post-dinner struggle to empty his bowels. I took my little bit of steak, sat with my back against the cell wall, and bit into it. Something crackled under my front teeth. I looked and saw a piece of paper, hardly bigger than a fortune cookie fortune, tucked into a slice in the meat. I took it out. Written in neat and tiny cursive, the handwriting of an educated man, was this.
I will help you if I can, my prince. There is a way out of here from the official's room. It is dangerous, Destroy this if you value my life. Yours in service, Percival.
Percival, I thought. Not Percy, but Percival. Not a gray slavey, but a real man with a real name. I ate the paper. 6. The next day we had sausages for breakfast. We all knew what that meant. Hamie looked at me with desolate eyes and a smile.
At least I'm done with the belly cramps. No more straying into shit, either. Do you want these?
I didn't, but took his 4 links, hoping they'd give me a little extra energy. They sat in my stomach like lead. From the cell on the other side of the corridor, Claw was looking at me. No, that's wrong. He was eye-fucking me. Iota gave me a shrug that said, "What are you gonna do?" I gave it back to him. What indeed? There was waiting. We had no way to keep time, but it slowed anyway. Fremy and Stook sat side by side in their cell. Fremy said,
"As long as they don't put us against each other, old pal, that's all."
I thought they probably would, because it was cruel. That, at least, turned out to be wrong. Just when I began to believe it wouldn't be today after all, 4 night soldiers appeared, Aaron in charge. He was always on the field during playtime, waving his limber stick like a conductor's baton. But this was the first time he'd come to Deep Malene since taking me to see the Lord High. And to check out the torture chamber, of course. The cell doors rattled open on their rusty tracks.
"Out! Out, kiddies! A good day for half of you, a bad one for the rest."
We stepped out of the cells, all but a slight, balding man named Hatcha.
"I don't want to," he said. "I'm sick."
One of the night soldiers approached him, but Aaron waved him off. He stood in the door of the cell Hatcha shared with a much bigger man named Quilly, who hailed from Deesk. Quilly shrank back, but Aaron's aura brushed him. Quilly gave a soft cry and clutched his arm.
"You are Hatcha, of what was once called the Citadel. Is that right?"
Hatcha nodded miserably.
"And you feel ill. The sausages, perhaps?"
"Maybe,"
Hatcha said, not looking up from the trembling knot of his hands.
"Probably."
"Yet I see you ate all but the strings."
Hatcha said nothing.
"Listen to me, kiddie. It's the Fair One or the Maiden. I'd see to your time visiting that lady myself, and it would be long time. I'd close the door slow. You'd feel the spikes touch your eyelids. Just gentle, you know, before they punched through. And your stomach. Not as soft as your eyes, but soft enough. What's left of those sausages will come dribbling out while you scream. Now, does that sound like a treat?"
Hatcha groaned and stumbled from the cell.
"Excellent. And here we all are,"
Aaron cried.
"Off to the games we go. Hump, kiddies. Hump, hump, hump. Such fun awaits."
We humped. As we made the climb we'd made many times before, but never until then, knowing only half of us would come back, I thought of my dream. Of Leah saying,
"You're faster than you think, Prince Charlie."
I didn't feel fast. 7. Instead of going directly to the field, we were marched into the team room we'd been using after practices. Only this time, the Lord High was there, resplendent in a full dress uniform which looked blue-black inside his aura. He was fully charged up for the occasion. I wondered where the energy that powered those auras came from, but such questions weren't much of a priority that day. On the shelf, where there had been 31 buckets for washing after playtime, there were now just 16, because only 16 would need to clean up after the day's festivities. In front of the shelf, propped on an easel, was a large poster board with "Fair One First Round" printed at the top. Below it were the matchings. I remember them perfectly. I think in such a terrible situation, a person would either remember everything or nothing at all. I apologize for throwing out even more new names, but I must, if for no other reason than those with whom I was imprisoned deserve to be remembered, if only briefly.
"Here you see the order of battle," Kellen said. "I expect you all to put up a good show for His Majesty Eldon. Do you understand?"
No one replied.
"You may find yourself pitted against one you consider a friend, but friendship no longer matters. Each contest is to the death. To the death. Bringing your opponent low but not killing him will only earn both of you far more painful deaths. Do you understand?"
It was Claw who replied.
"Yes."
He looked at me as he said it and drew a thumb across his enormous neck and smiled.
"The first set comes soon. Be ready."
He left. The other night soldiers followed him. We examined the poster board in silence. Fair One, first round. First set. Fremy to Murph. Jaya to Hami. Amit to Whale. Second set. Yano to Freed. Jacka to Iota. Measle to Sam. Third set. Tom to Bolt. Dami to Kamet. Bendo to Dash. Noons. Fourth set. Double to Eva. Stooks to Hatcha. Pag to Quilly. Fifth set. Burned to Gully. Hilt to Akka. Eris to Viz. Sixth set. Claw to Charlie. I had seen similar seedings, not just on TV during the NCAA Selection Sunday, but in person, when the matchups for the Arcadia Babe Ruth tournament were announced each spring on posters at every participating field. That was strange enough, but the most surreal element was that single word in the middle. Noons. Flight Killer and his retinue would watch 9 prisoners killed in battle, then enjoy a spot of lunch.
"What would happen if we all refused?"
Amit asked in a ruminative tone of voice I wouldn't have expected from a fellow who looked as if he once earned his bread and cheese shoeing horses, and knocking them flat if they didn't cooperate.
"Just asking, mind you."
Akka, a big fellow with a nearsighted squint, laughed.
"Do you mean a strike? Like the millers in my father's time? And deprive the Flight Killer of his day's entertainment? I think I'd rather live until tomorrow than spend this one screaming in agony, thank you very much."
And I thought Akka probably would live until tomorrow, considering he'd be fighting skinny little Hilt, who had a lame hip. Akka might go down in the second round, but if he won today, he would still be alive to wash up afterward and eat dinner tonight. I looked around and saw the same simple calculation on many faces. Not, however, on Hamie's. After one look at the board, he had gone to a bench and now sat there, head hanging. I hated to see him that way, but I hated the ones who had put us in this terrible position even more. I looked at the board again. I had expected to see Fremy against Stooks, and the two women, Jaya and Eris, against each other. A girl fight, what could be more amusing? But no, There didn't appear to have been any thought about the seedings. They might have been drawn out of a hat. Except for the last one, that was. Just the two of us on the field. The day's finale. Claw to Charlie.